Yes, well then, you know, why are we so prudish, Rabbi? Why can't we have the gear? Why can't... And if I say I didn't kiss her, then it's intellectually dishonest. So, but come on, like, at least give me make it hard. Raise level of difficulty. So I said, you know what, let's take a few steps back. Let me bring it to my neck of the woods. You know, when you take a few steps back in life, then you're in Lichtenstein territory. You're not looking at the question, you're just looking at the whole totality, and you probably forget the question anyway. You're just talking about life, and by the time I get around to it, I'll be so bored, you'll be asleep. Let's take 10 steps back. Right? You don't answer the question we learned this year. Everything has to be thought of panoramically. What does it say about the system? Every question is really a manifestation of something deeper and existential. We don't just deal with questions. What are the parameters? What are the guidelines that are affecting it? I told them Judaism has had four periods of history. The first period is the first 2,500 years before Har Sinai. This is a period of humanity, capped off by 400 years in which one group of people, led by Avram, discovered Hashem. No Har Sinai, no mitzvos, at least is mandatory. That's the first period of human history / Jewish history. The second period of human history, Jewish history actually, is about 1,200 years from Yetzias Mitzrayim, 2448, till the end of the second Beis HaMikdash. You see, about 700 years till the Beis HaMikdash, 400, about 1,300 years. That's the period of Revelation, that's the period of Nevuah, that's the period of Tanakh, the period of David, period of Shalom, period of Chizkiah, period of Nevi'im. That's the second period. The third period of Jewish history is the last 2,000 years. That's the period of Galus, but in terms of our experience, if the first period is the period of our Avos discovering Hashem, and Imos, and the second period is the period of Har Sinai, Nevuah, prophecy, Beis HaMikdash, Eretz Yisrael, the third period is Rabbinic period, Masorah, Torah Shebaal Peah, Gzeros, Takanos, Torah. And the fourth period, which I think began 1948, if you're a Haredi, it hasn't begun, but it will begin at some point. The quadrants are there. The question is how you assign the dates. The fourth period is the redemptive period, the final period of history. I think we're in the fourth period, but there are going to be four periods of Jewish history. Avos, Beis HaMikdash, Nevuah, Tanakh, Takanas Chachamim, Masorah, Torah Shebaal Peah, and Gula, Meos HaMashiach. Now, a Jew has a responsibility to stream their identity and their experience through all four periods, or at least the first three. We can't really stream it forward. We can anticipate it. We can participate in it. We can't really know it because it hasn't occurred yet. But you should feel the influence of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, of Rivka, Sarah. You should feel, who were they? How did they impact this world? What was their delivery to this world? You're their grandchild. You're their granddaughter. What does that mean for you? What's the response? You're chosen. It's not a bigoted statement. It's not a racist statement. It means you have a responsibility to be protector of humanity, to be the Avengers. You know, in your turn. You have to be that guard, that honor guard. You have to study Tanakh. Thank God we've had a keyhole into that second period, which had been neglected for hundreds of years. People stopped studying Tanakh. So who is David? Who is Shlomo? Who is Chizkiah? Where did Yirmiyah live? Now all of a sudden we study Tanakh and we're part of that world. That world, maybe close the window, I think, because the air conditioning is on? Or it isn't?
It is on.
It is on, okay. So that's the... Also, because I'm making a lot of noise. Thank you. That's the second period, the period of Tanakh. The third period is, of course, Torah Shebaal Peah, Halacha, Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam. Now, here's the catch, girls. We have to be sensitive to all those three periods, but there's a recency bias. Namely, the most recent period is going to affect us the most, by definition, because Avram didn't really live our reality the same way the Rambam lived. Avram lived 3,000 years ago. The Rambam lived 800 years ago. The Rambam lived after Har Sinai. Avram lived before Har Sinai. So as great as Avram was, as much as he was the godfather of this all, but the Rambam statements are going to be more direct and more focused and more relevant than Avram's statements are going to be more general. So we have a responsibility to live all those periods, but disproportionately. And then when I finished boring him to death, I said, yeah, Yaakov kissed Rachel, but he lived in this period, before there was Har Sinai, before there was Takanas Chazal, and in that period, for whatever reason, it was perfectly appropriate for an unmarried man to kiss his cousin who he missed, who he wanted to marry, on the cheek. In our period, after Chazal came, for all sorts of reasons, and issued Takanas, it's no longer appropriate. So just because Yaakov kissed Rachel doesn't mean your son should go kiss his girlfriend. Okay, so I was trying to present to him, that's the duality in this week's Parsha between Yehoshua and Caliph. And it's an important duality. It's a good way to give you some framework for how to combine these two. How does Yehoshua resist? How does Yehoshua oppose this mob incitement, this fomenting anger and slander? Well, who's Yehoshua's Rebbe? Moshe. Yeshua's got this cozy relationship with Moshe. We see him in Parshas Ki Tisa waiting for Moshe by the mountain. Remember, on that day, waiting for Moshe on the bottom of the mountain will get you killed. Anyone who disagrees with the mob that day gets killed. That's why Aaron caves. Miriam's son Hur opposes them and gets slaughtered. So waiting by the foot of the mountain is an act of courage. He's separating himself from this orgy. He's separating himself from this mess. He's taking his life into his hands. He's the same Yeshua who leads them into battle with Amalek, and it's almost like a puppet and a puppeteer. Moshe's directing it from above, and Yeshua knows his every move, like shadow dancing. That's Yeshua who defends Moshe's honor last week in Parshas Balos. Remember those two Nevi'im, Eldad Omeidad, and Yeshua says, Adoni Moshe claim, they have to be punished. Yeshua is dedicated to Moshe. So Moshe calls in Yeshua before the Odyssey begins, and he says, I'm changing your name. And he doesn't just add a letter. I mean, had he changed his name to, I don't know, Dehoshua? Dalet is a pretty generic vanilla letter. They're iconic letters. What are the iconic letters? Aleph's an iconic letter. Yud, Mem, Tav. These are the Hey. These are the iconic letters. You add a Yud, that's iconic. You add a Yud, you're converting him from Hoshea to Yehoshua. You're adding Hashem's name to the mix. So this is not just a name change. This is an I believe in you moment. I expect in you. Good tip. Tip number one for today. The best way to raise people's level of performance is to raise expectations of them. You'll find that people act up to expectations. If you ramp down expectations, they will play according to you raise expectations primarily through your own behavior. If you set a standard and you expect others quietly, not in a way that's arrogant, way that's condescending, or holier than thou, but you say, these are my standards, this is how I lead my life. I don't just play to public interest, public pressure. You'll see people will respond in most cases, if you believe in them. So Moshe believes in Yeshua. And you could just imagine Yeshua lying down in that tent in the middle of the desert as the Meraglim are out by the campfire conspiring. What do we say tomorrow? How are we going to submarine this whole process? Yeshua saying, My Rebbe Moshe. He believes in me. That's my source of strength. Right? I look at Rav Lichtenstein, look at Rav Amital. These are my sources of strength. Kalev is a nobody. We don't know who Kalev is. Happens to come from Miriam's family. But we don't know. I mean, the Pasuk doesn't tell us. Kalev ben Yefuneh, who's Yefuneh? And you know what? It's not just that he's a nobody, but it sounds like his name. Can you imagine when they decide to name him? So everyone's sitting around the tent, and Kalev's father, Yefuneh, turns to Mrs. Yefuneh and says, let's name our son after an animal. The baby's saying, great. Why? Call me Ari. Call me a good name. And the father says, how about if we name our son after a dog? And the son's saying, no, ask me. It's Kalev. He's named Kalev. Okay, so these aren't aristocrats. You're not an aristocrat. You're not naming your kid Kalev. Remember the first Nesim in the beginning of Bamidbar, these have very, very prestigious names. Shlumiel Ben Suri Shaddai. That's the first group of Nesim. Hashem's name. Ruel. Elitzur, Hashem is my rock. I can imagine having the name Shlumiel Ben Suri Shaddai. Like, wow, that's a heavy name for a little kid. And one of Rav Amital's best stories, I'll just tell you another story of Rav Amital. One of his best stories was he was at a bris, at a Haredi bris. And someone got up and they named the kid Tuvia. That was the name of the boy. And all of a sudden, during all the speeches of the bris, they were calling him Tuvia Eloi should be this, and Tuvia Eloi should be that, and Tuvia Eloi should be this. So Rav Amital went over to the parents and said, did I miss something? I thought his name was Tuvia. You're calling him Tuvia Eloi. Eloi means brilliant. So they said, I want him to get used to hearing himself called Eloi. And Rav Amital said, no, that's not what you do to a kid. You don't give him too much expectation. You make it easy. What does it mean for a little kid to grow up at the age of 3 and hear that he's expected to be an Eloi? He'll have a nervous breakdown by the time he's 5. John Stuart Mills taught his brothers Latin at the age of 4 and he had a breakdown. I mean, you don't. You have to try to reduce the tone, give people a place to breathe and let them grow. And Rav Amital always was very mocked, but he said, I'm not here to create gedolim. You're here to raise your children to be healthy over the Hashem, to be happy with the Yerach Shamayim. If they want to go further, that's their move. But don't swing for the fences. Any baseball fans? Anyone like baseball? Swing for the fences. High homer rate, high strikeout rate. You try to hit long ball, you're going to have a lot of strikeouts. So you try to make gedolim, you have a lot of people, nervous breakdowns. And that's always the derech I followed in my life and in my family. So much so that, does Shani teach it?
No, she doesn't.
So when Chani's oldest boy was bar mitzvahed, so a couple of the people in his family got up and gave all these surpassing speeches about what he should become. And one of them said, his name is Ashi, he's now 27 years, said, Ashi, you're now bar mitzvah. No more fun. No more games. No more chocolates for you, Ashi. And he sat down. Then it was my turn to speak. And I said, Ashi, trust me, I have a masara for my Rebbe. I'm not going to give you any Devar Torah. Keep eating chocolates. And I sat down. That's my Devar Torah. And it's over if I gave him a chocolate bar. But I said, this is Rav Amital story. So he came over to me the other night at Bar Mitzvah. He said, I remember my Bar Mitzvah. He told me to keep eating chocolates. Where did I get this? I'm Rav Amital. So he's a Bar Mitzvah boy. Let him eat chocolate. Let him have a good time. Let him play ball. Let him enjoy it. All of a sudden, you create these robots who you stress out with all this expectation. So imagine that poor kid, Shlumiel ben Tzuri Shaddai, Shalom Kael Tzuri. Let's just call him, you know, Jimmy. I don't know, just call him a nice name. Let him be a kid. But don't call him a dog. So this guy, Kalev, doesn't really come from anywhere. Where does he come from? Doesn't know anyone. As far as Moshe is concerned, he's invisible. He's a ghost. Reminds me, I used to learn with, you know her. She's, what's her name? Sarah Berman. She went to. Yeah. So her father was my best friend. Is my best friend. I just had dinner with him in Tunic. Oh, really? Right. So we're chavrusas. For many, many years in Gush. And as you probably know, his father, Sarah's grandfather, was best friends with the Vulchinstein. Now, when I say best friends, I don't mean donor. I mean best friends. They were buddies. They were good friends. So Ellie and I learned together several years in Gush, Sarah's father. So Rav Lichtenstein would always come over to Ellie and inquire about how he's doing. Does he need a lift to Yushalayim? And does he need some cake? Like you would, like you'd go over to your best friend's child, right? Let's say one of your parents were best friends with Esty. So it would be totally normal for Esty, because you've been in the house, you've been alone, to show you extra care because she's your best friend's daughter. So Rav Lichtenstein would always come over to his best friend's son, who happened to be my chavrusa, and he didn't know I existed. I'd say, hello, I'm here, I'm in the room, say something. I was Kalev, I was a ghost. He didn't know, Ellie this and Ellie that, and Ellie can I do this and Ellie can I do that. I was the Kalev. No, it's Kalev. Where does Kalev get his strength from? Anyone know? What does Kalev do to give him his resistance? If I go to Davin and Chevron. Let's read the Gemara in Sota. The Gemara in Sota says, Vayalu ba-Negev, Vayavo at Chevron. They all ascend in the south, and he comes to Chevron. See the difference? They all ascend, Vayalu, Vayavo, and he arrives. This happens to be, I didn't quote the Rashi, but this happens to be my favorite Rashi at Latar. I love Rashi, this is my favorite Rashi. Why? Because if you look at Rashi in this week's Parsha, he has all sorts of proofs from Sukkim that Chevron is a mountainous region, because it says Vayalu at Chevron. Because Rashi lived in France in the 11th century and never lived near Chevron. I just opened up my back door and I see, oh, there's a lot of mountains in Chevron. I don't have to prove the Pasuk. Rashi had to connect this Pasuk, and there, because he's in France. And how does he know what Chevron looks like? Just go to Rami Levi, go to the parking lot, and you'll see the mountains of Chevron. It's right there. So I always love reading this Rashi and Shlach and saying, you know, I think I can erase this. I don't know how to erase Rashi, but just go to my backyard and I'll show it to you. So what happens? So the Pasuk Gemara says, Amar Rava melamei chepiresh kolev me'atzas meraglim v'halach v'nishtateach al kivri avos amal mavosai bikshu le'rachamim shenet she'natzel me'atzas meraglim Yoshua, Chazal creating this contrast, Yoshua kvar bikesh moshe le'rachamim shenim rav ekra moshe l'shev ben yun Yoshua Ya Yoshiach HaMetzah Smeragla. I didn't chsev, the Abdi Kalev, Ekeva Simrocha Charzima. Namely, Yoshua and Moshe are a contrast in two different ways of drawing strength. Moshe as his contemporary Rebbe. Yoshua is Moshe's Talmud. Yoshua looks to Moshe. Yeshua has his contemporary voice. Kalev looks thousands of years earlier to Jewish history. And you have to be able to, there are two extremes in our world. You have to be able to bridge the two. We've got some people that are only Kalev and some people that are only Yoshua. Some people are only Yoshua. They've got their Rebbeim, their Rosh Hashiva, their Gedolim in 2019, and they're absolutely convinced that it was always this way. They're absolutely convinced that Moshe Rabbeinu wore Shreimel, spoke Yiddish, and ate B'chah. Because that's how I grew up. And that's how my rabbi. And there's no sense of Jewish history. There's no sense of, well, what was Avram's life like? And what was the Rambam's life like? And what was it like to be in Yemen? And what was it like to be in Alexandria? What was it like to be in Babylonia? What about the Gaon? What about different streams? And they don't feel that richness based on the entire depth and sweep of Jewish history. They only build their Jewish identity based on what they see. And it's hard. It's hard to escape the prison of the current, the prison of your current reality. It's like, well, it's just assume if my Rebbe teaches me this way and my Rebbe teaches me that way. And so some people are only Yeshua. They've only got that Rebbe in the present, the Rebbeim in the present, the Masor in the present. They can't imagine a previous sweep of Jewish history. And Kalev goes back thousands of years, or in this case, hundreds of years, because he lives in the Midbar. On the other hand, some people use the past to deflect the current future, the current reality. I love when people say, oh, I know that the rabbis say this way or that way, but if the Rambam were alive today, that's like so funny. What, like your ventriloquist? You're putting the Rambam on your lap, make him say things? The Rambam were alive today to have a heart attack. He'd get into a car and he'd say, where are the horses? And he'd get into a plane and say, why, where are we going? And after he had 17 heart attacks, maybe he could articulate some idea about what you're saying. That's not fair. If the Rambam were alive today, he'd be in favor of. If Rabbeinu Sachikon, that's intellectually dishonest. You make any dead person be the dummy on your lap and be a ventriloquist and put words into his mouth. Contemporary people know the situation, experience the same reality you do, and respond to it. That's why you have to have that recency bias. You have to be more attuned. And you have to be able to calibrate between those two. You have to be able, on the one hand, to listen very, very carefully to contemporary Torah voices. There was an article published in Mishpacha magazine that was included in, because I spoke about, I spoke in some panels, so they carried some of my comments. And in those comments, I was quoted as saying, I don't believe in Das Torah. So it made like a real stir, and people were asking me, what do you mean? You don't believe in Samchus Chacham? I said, no, you got it wrong. I believe in Samchus Chacham. I don't believe in the following. When it comes to halacha, I believe in Das Torah. You ask a posek, and his psak is final. Now, who do you ask? That you choose your posek. Sometimes you can posek it for yourself if you have enough knowledge. If not, you have to go to a higher posek. But if I go to the posek says, Aser, it's Aser. And I don't say, well, that's your opinion. That's he's more authoritative, and he issues a psak. When it comes to moral issues, so I don't see it as concrete, because moral issues are never as concrete. The chicken is aser for you, just like it's aser for me. So the same posek can create an objective response that will be across the board. Moral issues are very context-specific, very person-specific. They're not black and white. They're not binary. They're not on or off. So I want to consult moral / religious issues with Torah personalities, because I believe that Torah, when studied right, should confer overall moral awareness, because that's the seed of morality and the seed of religion. So it goes to reason that people that have studied more Torah and have studied it right, people whose character development and character reflects, some people study Torah and it doesn't really seep in. But if it seeps in and creates that personality, you'd expect that person to be a resource for moral growth. And if you're asking me personally, I think it's one of the failures of the modern Orthodoxy. Let's sound Dati Lomi, but if you ask me one of the failures in modern Orthodox societies, you do have a lot of people that are self-arbitrators, that don't have moral void, don't have, I don't know if your parents, I can say this with freedom, but just ask, think of your parents, think of your friends, think of how many of them would go to rabbis and listen to Psak blindly, which they should, and ask the questions rather than shuffle them under the carpet. And then how many of them would actually also go to rabbinic personalities, which is Torah, it doesn't have to be a rabbi, but Torah-based personalities, and say, I've got this moral issue, I want to hear what you have to say about it. And take it very seriously. When I went through Rav Lichtenstein and I discussed moral issues, even if I didn't agree with him, it took me 3 days to disagree. So let me think about it for 3 days. Let me hear, because if he's saying it, then there's got to be some wisdom to it. I didn't always agree because it wasn't a psak. With a psak, you have to obey the psak. With the moral guidance, you have to listen very carefully. But you're not just adrift. You don't just make independent or autonomous moral decisions. Das Torah, the way it's conjugated or conjured today, is the implication that you want to ask rabbis not just about halachic questions, not just about more religious developmental questions, but about medical procedures, stock advice, surgery, buying a house, whom to marry, things of that sort. I don't believe in that, right? I don't want to get stock advice from a rabbi. I don't give stock advice. In the early 90s, I started to day trade like everyone else. I lost money, believe me. It took me about a day to realize, stick to your rabbinics. Don't go into day trading. Don't start, invested in this rather than Intel. I could have been rich if I invested in Intel. Who knows? but stick to your trade. So I don't believe, as some people do, I believe in theory in Das Torah. In theory, if you have prophecy, you should have access to information supernaturally that we don't. We just don't have prophecy. So in theory, the mechanism of Das Torah is workable. We just don't have anyone to practice it today. So I don't believe in Das Torah. But you have to find rabbinic influence. You have to find people that you turn to and you consult with and you get psak from and you're serious and assiduous about asking these halacha questions from. But you can't blind yourself to your past. You can't say, oh, well, if everyone's acting this way and there's only one approach to think about the fact that there those four periods that I spoke about, the sweep of Jewish history. On the other hand, sometimes people deflect religious growth by looking to the past. You ever heard the following statement? I'm sure you've heard it. I'll say it in a comical way, but I'm sure you've heard it. My grandfather was a very, very religious man, and he, fill in the blanks. When do you hear people making that statement? When they want to avoid, well, my grandmother was a very religious person, and she went mixed dancing. Of course she did, because mixed dancing saved Judaism. You're all a product of mixed dancing in America. Because of that mixed dancing in the synagogue ballroom, Matzei Shabbos, the men would be in bars marrying Christian girls. Mixed dancing literally saved Judaism. It was a way to get Jewish boys and girls together on Matzei Shabbos and let them dance together and hopefully get married and build Jewish families in 1955, where the alternative would have been at O'Reilly's bar down the block. And now it's 2019, and we don't go mixed dancing. And mixed swimming was a way to get people to get together for summers and holidays and just hang out by the pool rather than being who knows where. And now we try as best we can, within range, not to mix our sexes when we're not dressed in a way that we can maintain that type of discipline. So it's just a different period. It's just, and I think that's why sometimes there's a lot of tension when kids come to Israel, because parents don't. My greatest dream is for my kids to be more firm than I am, because I'm a platform, because I'm a second generation Holocaust survivor. I mean, namely, my parents grew up in a Holocaust home, but I know what it is to be in a Holocaust home. I know the difference. I know what it means to sit at a Seder with 3-5 people at the table rather than 30 people at the table because everyone else is dead. I know what it is to meet people who seriously simply can't be in the presence of children. When I was a child, I would visit some family members and there was a clock. And after 45 minutes, I had to leave because this family member lived through a Kristallnacht and saw children being dragged through the streets of Germany and could not bear looking at children. I remember holding my glass and having my glass taken away. This person cannot have glass in her vicinity because she lived through so much trauma with glass. So I know what it is. I know the difference. And I know how hard it is to build religious depth in the wake of the Holocaust. We lost our Masorah. Think about what your Masorah is. Think about all your Pesachs with your family. Think about all your Rosh Hashanahs with your family. Think about how much you've gotten from your grandparents, from your, in some cases, your great. I didn't have that. And I certainly saw people who had much less than I had. So we're recovering, and each generation builds a platform. The next generation can move beyond, doesn't it? And you're not rendering judgments about the previous generation. The previous generation went mixed dancing and saved Judaism by going mixed dancing. Now we're at a stage where it's no longer progress, no longer. Let me give you a different story, okay? Non-New Yorkers. I'm talking to the non-New Yorkers now, okay? The New Yorkers, you know what I'm talking about? I don't have to explain this. The non-New Yorkers. There's a fascinating anthropological phenomena that takes place right around now. About 500,000 Orthodox Jews move to the Catskill Mountains before the summer. Now, what makes it fascinating anthropologically? You literally have like pop-up cities, pop-up supermarkets, pop-up restaurants, pop-up doctors, pop-up dentists, because there are 500,000 Orthodox Jews that move an hour and a half from New York. How many Jews are there in Australia? 50,000?
Yeah.
So imagine 10 times the amount of Jews in Australia all moving at once to one location. It's crazy. And you have people just opening up, law firms, tax firms, whatever you need to survive for 500,000 people, it's like a pop-up.
They don't have all that up
there. Everything. 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 Remember when I was a rabbi in Hask a long time ago, so I looked in the paper. They've got these books, these classifieds. And I saw that someone had Hamish dentistry. So I'm like, oh my goodness, what does that mean? instead of extracting my tooth with tweezers, he's going to tie me to a horse. Like, I don't want my dentist to be Hamish. I want my dentist to be professional. I'll take the Hamish potato cooker, but not the Hamish dentist. Like, what's it going to be? Betsy and Bula, the two cows pulling my tooth out? He's a Hamish, because there's a lot of Hasidim and a lot of Hamish dentist. It's incredible. Literally, 500,000 people. It's just fascinating to watch from a purely demographic, anthropological standpoint. Anyway, why am I telling you this background? A friend of mine told me a story, an older person, and he said that he remembers once in Queens, which is a big concentration of where Jews live in, not Queensland, Queens, and he was pushing his carriage September 1st with his baby down Jewel Avenue, which is the main street in Queens where all the Jews live. And all of a sudden, everyone's making eyes at him. Why are you pushing your carriage? Rolling their eyes, looking at him meanly. He's like, finally, why are they looking at me like that? He says, oh, why are you pushing your carriage down Jewel Street? It's Rosh Hashanah Rabbim. It's Shabbos. Oh, you in the country. That's how they call the Catskills. The country for the summer. The country. You're in the country for the summer. When you were in the country, in those days not that many people went, just because it wasn't a highway. They had to drive through local villages. He says, when you were away for the summer, the rabbi told us we're not supposed to push our carriages in public because it's an Isser Deraisa. You missed that. You were in the country. Namely, rabbis were sitting there making triage decisions what they should and shouldn't tell their congregants in 1960 because no one was from. And if you tell too much, no one's going to keep it anyway. They were making triage, not about specific chumras. They were making triage about hotzah in Rosh Hashanah Rabbim on Shabbos. They were allowing people to push their carriages or drive to shul on Shabbos because they were just doing whatever it takes to keep orthodoxy alive. On life control. So I was saying, oh, my grandmother was. Okay, but now we're in a different stage, and certain things are, there's an expression in sports when the game moves away from you. You know, you have these old skills, but the game is now very different. You know, sometimes the people, like, society's moving away from them. You always have to feel and hear where society's moving and what the norms are. And that's really the composite of Moshe and Kalev. On the one hand, you have to have that Yoshua and Moshe. You have to have those Rabbanim, those modern, you can't live in the past and only in the past, because then it's all manipulative and it's all interpretive and it's all speculative. And I know what the Rambam would have said about women's learning. How do you know what the Rambam said about women's learning? It's like, it's intellectually dishonest. The Rambam lived in a world in which women were raving idiots. They didn't have education and it wasn't misogynist. It was just the unfortunate reality. So there's no way to even begin to have a voice about whether women should be educated. It's nonsensical to start making those syllogisms. It's just not fair intellectually. You don't know what the Rambam would have said about Torah Mada. The Rambam studied science, yeah. But the average Balabas in the Rambam's day, and he records this, studied 9 hours of Torah a day. Are you listening? The average professional in the Rambam's day in the 12th century studied 9 hours of Torah. So it's just as likely that if you ask the Rambam, should we study anything outside of Torah? It's just as likely he would say yes after 9 hours of Torah. That's just as likely as saying the Rambam knew science and math and astrology and medicine, therefore it's hard to know. Because everything is different. People today barely study Torah. It's hard to know. So just don't even try. And sometimes you have people that deflect religious growth by running and taking refuge in the past. Well, my grandfather, well, the Rambam, well. And sometimes people are just stuck in the narrowness of the present. They can't say, well, there's some other reality. And how do you find that mix? How do you live Tanakh? How do you live the Avos? How do you live Rabbinic Judaism, Halachic Judaism, but still realize that disproportionate bias that the more contemporary and recent realities have to exert upon you? That's the going away challenge. Don't let yourself become radicalized to either direction. Don't let yourself get stuck in the present. Let yourself get lost in the past. The present is more telegraphic, the past enriches, and it's a more endowed sense of heritage. And certainly those who are leaving, what did you spend this year? I mean, I hope at some level, at some very deep level, even if you haven't thought about it until now, you spent the year because you wanted to be with Israelis. Okay, great. You spent here in the Migdal Oz because you wanted to be in the broader Gush Migdal Oz Hashkafa. You spent the year. But there's a difference. Spending the year right here, 10 miles from Kever Rachel, 10 miles from Aras Machpelah, that should mean something to you, that wherever you end up in life, you're part of that historical nexus, that you spent the year with your avos and imos. And hopefully those worlds are more resonant than they were before you came here. And they're more resonant than if you just would have gone to some institution somewhere without the location aspect of it. Okay, so that's the going away parshas shlach component. Maybe the second going away, which is not really so much for going away, but it is an important message. Take a look at source number Gimel. Okay? The day that this all came to a head, all these complaints and worries and concerns, was Tisha B'Av. So Tisha B'Av essentially is preordained because of the Meraglim. Meraglim determined that Tisha B'Av will be a day of sadness and a day of tragedy. But listen to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu says. Hayomer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hein bachu b'chia shel chinam, v'ani ekva lehem b'chia ledaros. Hashem isn't concerned that they cried and that they complained, that they clamored. Hashem's concerned that it was empty. B'chia shel chinam. Let me put it to you this way. There's a very, very thin line. Now, speaking especially to the girls going back to America, because this is part of your challenge to you of living Israel even when you're not yet living in Israel. There's a very, very thin line between precaution and panic. Precaution is a legitimate response to danger. Panic is a lack of chisar, a lack of emun, a lack of bitachon. Precaution means there are dangers. You take your precautions. You respond different ways. And sometimes our precautions are very precautionary and very conservative. There are people who moved. I was talking before about the first intifada. But we lived through life here in the Gush during the second intifada. And it was tough. It was really tough. I just made a bar mitzvah for my son. And one of my wife's co-workers, who she's very friendly with, came with her husband. And they said, we have to leave. We're just staying for the first part of the bar mitzvah. Where are you going? We're going to a memorial for Tzachi Sason. Now, how do I know the name Tzachi Sason? Because everyone knows the name Tzachi Sason. He's one of the people who were killed in Gush Etzion on the road near the Me'era, near the tunnel, during the Second Intifada. We know these names. Sarah Blaustein, I think he probably went to her grave on Yom HaZikaron, and Tzachi Sason, and Gillis, and we lived through these names, and I remember having a very distinct sense that when my wife left for work in 2001, 2002, I said, this may be the last time I see her. I wasn't never morbid death wish, or that, but I just, it was, there were things happening on the road. She used to wear, literally, breastplated, heavy ceramic, what do they call them? Bulletproof vest. And even some people wore helmets. Actually, people had helmets. It was hard. My wife loved when I wore, because she said, now you know what it feels like to be pregnant. It was really heavy. It's like waddling around. So the women loved it. They said, oh, now you can finally sympathize with us. You know what it's like to carry an extra 20 pounds. It's like 20 pounds. I still have it downstairs in my basement. Thank God we don't use it anymore. But I'm still carrying it around. And a lot of people left. Some people left. And don't judge the people who left. If you decided it wasn't for you, then our girl, who's now graduating from high school, she's going to be in Shirut Lamia next year. She's not coming to Migdalos yet. So her name is Tamima Emuna. And she's now 17. So she was born in 2002. And we named her Tamima. It's 2004, 2002, yeah, 2002. We named her Tamima Emuna because, first of all, my wife was very ill during her pregnancy. So we were davening a lot that she should be healthy and complete. And then she came out Tamima, so we called her Tamima. And Emunah, because we felt like we had to exert a lot of Emunah to stay here in the Gush during those periods. It was a trying time. It was a difficult time. It's her name. So some people... But what you see on display in Parsha Shlach is not precaution in the face of danger, in the face of challenge, in the face of overwhelming odds. You see panic. You see crying. You see people losing their senses. You see people speaking irrationally. That's where it goes south. I'll give you one or two examples from the Parsha. That's really the takeaway from Shlach. No one expects the Meraglim to come back and fabricate. No one expects the Meraglim to come back and simplify. Oh, we saw these giant warriors, and it's a fearsome country, but it's a cakewalk. Report. They're expected to give a report. But it's the tonality and the fear and the complaining and the crying and the panic and who knows, and the heavens are falling. Don't let yourself get into that state of panic. In life, and certainly in religious questions. Panic never helps anyone. It's an old story. It's not really a story, but you'll see what I mean by a story. About a person who leaves a hustling, bustling town of 200,000 people. And on his way out of town, he meets these two strange-looking people on the way to town. So he asks these people, where are you going? And people arriving in the town say, we're going to slaughter the entire town. So the man says, well, how do you expect to do that? They're strong people, they have their own army. So the guy says to him, one of the people says, hi, let me show you. My name is Plague. I'm going to cover the first 10,000. This is my friend. His name is Panic. He'll cover the other 500,000. It's when panic strikes that we lose our wits and we act irrationally and we stampede on each other and we throw away our resources. And you can handle situations. Learn to handle situations in life. It's great, great advice for marriage. Learn to handle it. You want to know who you get. You want to be the same person day in, day out. People like stability in life. Same person. You want to wake up next to the same person that you went to sleep next to and show up at the dinner table. People need to know that they're getting the same person, the same continuity. Try to be the same person. Obviously, you're different in different contexts. As you're young, it's harder to be that. You still feel these gyrations. You're one person today, and that's when the mood swings. Your wiring is still getting together. You're still growing physically. So it's a lot happening. But the goal is to be integrated, to have that sameness, that oneness, that continuity. So, for example, let's see some examples of panic. Okay? Vayilonu al Moshe, source number 2. Vayomer lehem kol eda, lu masnu be'eretz Mitzrayim. Wish we would have died in Egypt. Omer barzel lu masnu. V'lam Hashem mevi osanu el eretz hazel zinfol b'cheref. Hashem is bringing us just to slaughter us. Nashenu tov tov lan eshuv Mitzrayim. Is that real? Is that true? So sad. So sad. You'd rather walk back into Auschwitz? So it was an 80-year Auschwitz. At least I'll take my chances. I'll get into Israel. Maybe I won't conquer the land. Maybe I'll just live as a citizen in Israel. Maybe I'll go to Syria. I don't know. That's already panic. That's hyperbole. That's demagoguery. They were afraid Hashem maybe backstabbed us. Hashem promised us that he didn't come back. You could say, oh, but better in Egypt? Really? Better to die in the Nile? Rather have your kids thrown into mortar? Smashed in front of your eyes? Walk around naked all day like slaves? Eternal slaves? Slaves aren't a 6-year apprenticeship. Slaves is you and your family. That's already panic setting in. Exaggeration. Take a look at source number 4. Hanashim asher aluimu amru lo nuchal alo salam ki chazaku, they're too strong. They start to slander the giants. Look at the last line. The shamarinu is hanafilim, the giants. We felt like grasshoppers. Really? Okay. Look at the next line. And they also looked at us like grasshoppers. Don't go to that place where you project how people see you. Maybe they saw them in a different way. I know what I'm feeling. I know what you're feeling. I know that in the presence of giants, I feel small. But did they see me that way? Maybe they saw me as, I don't know, grasshoppers with sharp teeth. Maybe grasshoppers with sharp claws. Maybe grasshoppers with, like, heavy, heavy paws. I don't know. Maybe they didn't even notice. Maybe they didn't even notice them. Here they're projecting their own fear. You can tell fear a mile away. People project fear, project confidence, act like you belong. Why do they look at it? Because they were projecting into their minds. They were projecting their own fear. They were assuming that the Meraglim, that the local giants, saw them in the same way they saw themselves. And of course, when you see yourself as small, people start to see you as small. See yourself as large, and people will see you as large. Heck, don't even think about what people say about you. That's the Kutzkitz shot on this pasuk. It's not about what they thought the giants were seeing them as, but the fact they were even concerned with the giants looking at them. You can't stay within yourself. When you get into that place where you're always worried about how people are thinking about you, that's a rabbit hole that's hard to climb out of. What is he thinking about me? What is she thinking about me? Well, just stay in your space. Stay in your lane. All of a sudden, this obsession about how they see you, whether they see you as grasshoppers. I'm starting to show you the insanity of Shlach. And the insanity is driven by panic. Shlach could have been a very, very different read. There are giants. There are walled cities. This is the land that devours its inhabitants. Let's hatch a plan. Giants have ankles. Let's slip the ankles and rupture their Achilles tendon. I don't know. Well, let's read Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels. We'll find a way for the Lilliputian midgets to defeat the giants. There are ways to be giants. Mightier they are, the harder they fall. There are ways. There are ways to do it. There's always a way. And of course, the way here is HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises you, and he wants you to find a way. So have all these little one-liners that I give the boys for the first month, because the first month in yeshiva, as you know, is really, really hard. And it's very intimidating. Everyone has a nervous breakdown. So I've got four or five little things that I literally sink into their subconscious that they go to for support. So the Mishlei, Medrash Mishlei says, two people walk into a hallway. Huge vaulted ceiling. And there's a piece of bread hanging from the top of this really, really high ceiling. The silly person says, it's too high, I'll never get there. The wise person says, three words. Someone hung it. Someone hung it. So you walk into the Gush Beis Medrash, it's overwhelming. There are people there. And that's to say, I imagine it was with you also. People are just quote shots in their fingertips, and you say, like, I'm a nothing, I'm an inchworm. Especially when you used to be the valedictorian and the top, and I love that. I found one school, I should give it its credit. To me, that is the greatest, greatest client of overseas education. Thank God it doesn't exist in Israel. Valedictory awards. Why would you want to award one student on the broken hearts of 300 others? And Imtim Salomar, you want to break everyone's heart, and you want to make one girl or boy feel special. I mean, how about you live in a bizarro world where the girl with the blondest hair gets the award? We'd all say that's silly, right? That's stupid. The biggest nose gets the award. The smallest ears get the award. That would be really ridiculous, right? So now we're going to award people based on the amount of brain cells they have. Well, what does that even mean? If you force feed me, say, you're only going to be the principal, what would it take to make me a principal in America? I don't know, $10 million contract for a year. You force feed me to be a principal, I wouldn't take it either. But force feed. Okay? And you have to give an award. That's the condition. Say, okay, you know what the award should be? The best girl. Let's all sit down around the table and compile a list of the 10 character traits and go into character and identity. Humility, selflessness, kindness, curiosity, whatever they are. We'll have a panel of 10 people and we'll compile a list. Maybe intelligence will be one of 10. Probably not. It's not top 10 on my list. It doesn't really get you very far in life. Gets you into school. Gets you a big salary, doesn't really help with relationships. Sometimes it blocks relationships. Doesn't really help with self-image because you tend to think you're better than you are because in all these metrics you score so high. And you don't really look in the mirror and say, who am I and how can I change? And I'm not saying this for the 349 other kids in Frisch. I'm saying it for the valedictorian in Frisch because he or she is the biggest victim because they skate through high school having everyone tell them how great they are. And then real life happens and you're not great. Your wife could care less if you're smart. Your coworkers could care less. Are you a valedictorian? Is that right?
I'm a salutatorian.
Yeah. Okay. So break out of the prison. Okay. So I just why am I saying this? Why am I saying this? Because we want to be nice to the incoming boys and make them think like we care about them. What we did is we sent emails to all the schools, asking them to tell us which incoming Gush boys won awards, and we sent them nice letters just to give them mazel tov on their awards. So they'll know that we're paying attention. So we got a letter back from SAR, and SAR said, we don't have awards. So I was very proud. I know totally, my heart stuck well, so there's no awards. That's like really impressive. There's a school that can make that break. In Israel, I just went to my daughter's graduation from Rosh Hashanah. It was just beautiful. 30 girls got up there, beautiful productions, beautiful. You just tell the togetherness and the love that they felt for each other. There wasn't even a premise of who's smarter, who's better, who's brighter. It wasn't even on the docket. No one was even talking about it. It was just, we are graduating, we love each other, we spent the last 4 years together, we're looking to our future. It was like beautiful. Without the edginess of who's getting, who's not getting, they have to make up awards, citizenship award, good nature award, Taramada award, Tara. Like all these awards coming through your nose. Like, which high school? Central, right?
Central, yeah.
Okay, so again, it's not, no one introduced that crime, but it's just get away from it. Break out of it. If I know it incentivizes. But if that's the way you have to incentivize students, there's got to be a better way to incentivize students than just hardship and heartache. Now, how do we get into this conversation? I don't know how we got into this conversation. Nothing against it? What?
I said you were giving us advice.
About something, right. Always, always, always my advice. Okay. So another. Another sign of panic. This is the best one. This is the most transparent one. Look at source 5. This is not from the Meraglim story in Shlach. This is from the Meraglim story in Parshas Devarim. This is classic panic. Vateirugnu bi'alechem. They're crying. They're screaming. You don't even have this crying in the Pasuk in Shlach. You have the Chazal reporting about the crying. Atem b'chisem b'chiyah shel chinam. But here you actually have crying. Parshas Shlach, you have complaining. Here you have crying. Okay? Here's another bit of advice. Okay? When you have big decisions in life, take the emotions out of decisions. Don't make decisions based on emotions. Make decisions based on internal desire. What if I want more? But don't do it when you're in an emotional state, when you make the worst decisions when you make them based on emotional, you know, the emotions are great. I'm not saying to eliminate them, but decisions have to be cool-headed. They have to be balanced, be thought of. They have to say they're crying and screaming. And listen to what they say. They're not talking about where it's better to live. That they already said in Shlach, it's better to be in Egypt. They're not talking about how the giants of this land saw us little puny grasshoppers. They're saying, why did Hashem take us out of Mitzrayim? You know why he took us out of Mitzrayim? Listen, Vatarignu be'alechem, Vatamru, Besinas Hashem, Itanu, Osanu, Hotzianu, Meretz Mitzrayim. Hashem hates us. That's why he took us out of Mitzrayim. He hates us. Now, if I really hated you, I know, but if I really hated it, I can think of a lot of ways to express my hatred. The last thing I would do is invest all this effort in 10 miracles, taking you out of Egypt, splitting an ocean, delivering the Torah, supporting 3.5 million people, delivering them on every day because I hate you. Because I'm just setting you up for a fall. That. Rav Amital used to tell us, and I told you a lot this year about the Haredi position, and I think it's a legitimate position. And it's a legitimate position about life, and it's a legitimate position about Medinas Yisrael. But the Satmar position, which is hardcore Haredi, Neturei Karta, hardcore. Even in that hardcore, there's the hardcore and there's the hardcore, the ones that hang out with Hamas and that visit Iran. Very, very minimal. Maybe 20, 30 people. Those people are not Jewish. I would not sit at their table. I would not eat their meat. I would not drink their wine. They have a din of Rodef. Those people who are taking snapshots, who are supporting, holding placards, they are directly assisting in the killing of Jews. Because everything is public opinion and BDS, and it's all connected. Those people, they look like Jews, act like Jews, I won't count for a minion, they're off. They've left. They're Rodef. But then there's, I don't know how many Satmars there are, but you know what? You shouldn't need to. But many of you will meet them, in New York in particular. If you're ever in a hospital on Shabbos, any hospital in the greater New York area, and I mean any hospital, you'll be fed, clothed, housed, showered, and treated by Satmars. That's all they do. They hang around hospitals and help patients and their families. That's how much Avas Yisrael they have. So much so that it's actually creating political friction now in New York. Because they become so well versed in medical issues that they're actually counseling patients, and the doctors are getting upset about it. And it's not in a sinister way. Because in any system, there are loopholes and problems, and they've already identified these, and it's not fair to the system. It's not that the doctors aren't at fault and the chassidim aren't at fault. It's just simply clashing of interests. So they're trying to find a way to tweak the system. But seriously, this has been an issue. If you read through the New York Post, this has been an issue in New York. They're not calling it, let's get the Satmar Hasidim out of the operating theater. They're calling it patient privilege and doctor privilege, but they're not talking about Irish priests. They're talking about Satmar Hasidim for your behalf. When the Satmar Rebbe wrote his Sefer, Vayol Moshe, and said that we in this room are responsible for the Holocaust, because Zionism is directly the cause for the Holocaust, he said it with Ahavas Yisrael seeping out of his tongue. More Ahavas Yisrael than you'll ever have. He just, because he believed it, because he was so desperate to protect the Jewish people and not to repeat the Holocaust, he was trying to protect us. And he would never in a million years stand next to a Palestinian terrorist, never. But that notion, so now I'm not talking about the hardcore. They're out. But the Satmar, which are in, and they're Jews and full Jews and Abbas Yisrael Jews, that aspect, that they believe that the Zionist state was the act of Satan, Rav Amital disqualified that on these grounds. He said, Satan has power from Hashem. Remember, Satan isn't a rebel angel. It's not Satan. He's the Malach HaSharis, who gets up every morning and praises Hashem. You know what Satan's job is? to make you weak, to make you confused, to make you human. Because if you weren't, and you lived every day like the last 2 minutes of Yom Kippur, you wouldn't have freedom of choice. It'd be obvious to do the right thing. So for your choice to be real choice, you have to be struggling at it. So he makes you struggle. He makes you tired. He makes you lust. He makes you weak. He makes you... Satan has the power. Satan gives him the power to ensure your freedom of choice is real. Because sometimes it's so compelling that you lose your choice. I can tell you, Rav Aaron made us lose our choice. He was so compelling. His example was so overwhelming. It's like, whatever you say, okay, I'll just do it. Yeah, just sign me up. Want me to forget being a dentist and going back and live in the West Bank of the Arab, I'll be fine. It was just so, it was this irresistible force of moral courage. You couldn't avoid it. If you really tuned in and you're an honest person, you can get out of it. I have a friend who now is, is 80 or whatever it is. And Rav Aaron would ask you these questions, you'd lie because it'd be harder than saying no. Like, what are you doing? He says, I'm coming back to life. When you he's going to be a lawyer. But it was just embarrassing. Here's a person that was so far along that moral trajectory. And then, I'm going back to make money. You'd like be embarrassed to say it in a way that no one else made you embarrassed. Everyone else you're honest with. I decided to be a lawyer. I decided to live in New York. But you just couldn't say it because he was just so morally sensitive and conscious. So imagine HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You felt HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know that Hashem is holding your tube, your psychological tube, your medical tube, and every minute, Al Chaim v'chesed shechan antano, al nisim v'nefasecha, erev akav tzarayim, and all of a sudden, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm slapping you in the face. I'm doing an affair. It just doesn't make sense if you're honest with yourself. So the Satan creates this nerves. Optical illusion. Hashem isn't really supporting you. Hashem isn't really here. It's not about him, about you. He creates all this static and this commotion, this diversion, so that you have to make choices and really work at choices and try to see through the commotion and the static and the confusion. So that's Satan's job. Satan can climb into your heart and make you, weak. In your heart and make you tired. In your heart and make you lustful. In your heart and make you jealous. In your heart, whatever. But the Satan, the premise of the Satan Rebbe, that the Satan can reshape history and allow the Jewish people to win wars and create global geopolitical realities, because it's all a setup to see whether we'll respond and reject Zionism or accept it. Rav Amitil said that's bordering on Avodah Zarah. Satan isn't given that much power to reshape history. Satan means to make you a little tired on a Monday morning, not want to go to school, or go to minyan, or go do a mitzvah. That's Satan. Satan isn't reshaping history. Just I hear Rav Amitel's voice in this passage. Yeah, Hashem hates us. And since he hated us, he took us out of Egypt, split the sea, dayinu, just so we should fall. That's not what Hashem does. He's better things to do with his time. What's really happening? Come on, who hates whom? When they're saying Hashem hates us, who hates whom? What do we call that in psychology? Study Psychology 101? Not really. Reverse psychology is passive. Okay, so what do we call when I implant my feelings onto you, my traits, my flaws? Projection. It's really hard. It's really actually it's salutatorian, right? You know, it's really hard. It's really hard to look in the mirror and deal with your own flaws. You're looking at the mirror, your moral mirror, you're looking back and say, I've got this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem. So you know what you do? It's easier if you take them like a projector. And you project them on your friends. And you project them on your family members. And you project them on your siblings. Because you know them well. So you can actually see them. I'm going to project them on you. I don't know you well enough. It'll be a false projection. I can't see it in your life. I don't know your life that well. And my wife, I know really well. And my children, I know really well. And my siblings, I know really well. And my friends I know really well, so it's easier for me to deal with my own flaws by projecting them onto those close to me. Oscar Wilde, Picture of Dorian Gray, if you ever read that little novel, projected on the art form. This is classic projection. They hate God. This is a jailbreak. They're trying to run away from Hashem. So they say Hashem hates them. And Rashi picks this up. Look at this beautiful Rashi in Devarim. Rashi says, "Besinas Hashem osanu." This is about the Meraglim. Who haya oyev eschem? He loves you. Aval atem sonim oso. You hate him. Source 6. Mashal hedjer omer. You don't have to be a philosopher to get this. You don't have to be Kierkegaard to get this. You don't have to be Socrates to get this. Just ask an average farmer or shepherd or milkmaid and they'll tell you. What's in your heart about your friend, lover? He said, basically, you project your own feelings. You don't have to. We go through this every day. So why do they project? Because they're panicking. Because they lose it. Hashem hates us. We better die in Egypt. They look at us as grasshoppers. When you start to hear these words, you realize no one's really thinking. No one's really processing. It's all just demagoguery, panic, exaggeration. Try to avoid that in life. Try to say, let's bring it down. Let's start making decisions. Okay, let's make real, it's called substantive decisions. Real, this is good advice, not just about religion, but about life. Don't make decisions under panic. Don't respond in extreme fashion. Wait a couple days before you make major decisions. Take the emotions out of decisions. Sound off your decisions with other people. Listen. Assess the risk, reward. Just make decisions in a calm fashion. But certainly when it comes to Emunah Bitachon, where it's a religious question, not just a decision-making skill, precaution is fine. You have to take precautions. Chalila v'chas. Baruch Hashem, we're living now in a state of bliss. Baruch Hashem, the country is successful, and you had a successful year, and we should continue. But you know that the Middle East is a powder keg, and you know that we hope in Daven HaKadosh Baruch Hu that Mashiach will come in an easier route, but we know that it may be more challenging. And so you'll be on the other side of the pond, and you'll be responsible, seriously, if you live there, for making sure that you and your communities don't cross this line. Okay, I'll be very, very blunt with you. If you don't come to Israel during these moments, then that's panic. You're a lot safer in Israel. You know the safest year in Israel? Since in 71 years of its formation? Statistically, the safest year to live in Israel is 2002, the height of the Intifada. Why? Because people didn't travel that much. However many people were killed in terror, there are five times the amount of people were killed in road accidents. So whatever surge there was in fatalities because of terror, there was a disproportionate downtick. It was statistically safer to live in Israel 2002. One of my most beloved internet shiur. In the summer of 2014, 5 years ago? No, it was 3 years ago. When the boys are kidnapped? 5 years ago, right? 5 years ago. Summer of 2014. What?
Yesterday.
That summer, the Satmar Rebbe split into different groups. Satmar Rebbe in Monroe County, which is in Muncie, which is upstate New York, where a lot of Satmar Chassidim live, put out a statement that it was the fault of the parents that the three kids were killed, because they chose to expose them to danger by educating them in Gush Etzion. So everyone on the internet was responding like, you are morally outrageous, it's horrific, it's out of... And I didn't have to add my voice because everyone was jumping. I don't have to share in the feeding frenzy. I just have one point to make. So I entitled my show, I always like getting these titles that confuse people. Why I agree with the Satmar Rebbe. That got like 5,000 hits. Everyone, why would a gun-toting settler rabbi agree with the Satmar Rebbe? I said, I completely and totally agree that parents' first responsibility is to protect their children and raise them in a safe environment. Okay? I crunched the numbers, how many deaths there were in Monroe County that summer for adolescent males between the age of 13 and 17, based on drugs, based on crime, based on vehicular accidents. There were about 17 or 18 young males who died that summer in Monroe County. There were three people who died in Gush Etzion. I said, it's much safer for your kids to be in Gush Etzion than to be in Monroe County where the Satmar Rebbe lives. So everyone in Monroe County has a responsibility to bring their kids to Gush Etzion. And that's called panic. Terror is all panic. Just imagine that. Living in Israel in 2002, is just, you know it's all. You get on a plane, you feel a little scared. You are much safer on a plane than crossing the street anywhere. Anywhere. It's just how you process it. So you got to get past the psychology. You got to be stronger than psychology. You can't let psychology come to Israel. If there's a difficult time, come to Israel. Okay, so come to Israel and don't go to this area or go in a bulletproof truck or go in a this. But sense that I can't go to Israel. My children can't go to Israel anymore. One day you'll be a mother, Mirza Hashem, and your child will want to go to Israel. Say, oh, it's too hot. It's too dip. No. So go to this place. Go to that place. Stay. Don't stay. Don't use the roads. Take a cab. Don't take a cab. Remember during the Intifada, there were, I think, Rabbi Frisch, Rabbi Goldfisher, I think, if I'm not mistaken, when he was in Shia, maybe before. Rabbi Gardner Schwartz, for sure.
I don't know.
You know.
Do I know?
Rabbi Gardens wants them fresh. I think, no, he's not. A couple of years.
The phone, when he's in the car. What the dog is playing.
I had dinner with him, so.
He started teaching a year after, we had Rabbi Goldfisher, and then the next year.
So his condition with his parents were, he came to Gush, but he couldn't leave Gush for a whole year. Couldn't leave alone.
Yeah,
then
we have a
contest. Oh, you have a contest?
No.
There's a contest.
55 straight Shabbosos. My day, I almost made it. I was trying to gun for DiMaggio. 55 straight games of the hit, but that was hardcore. Okay, so those are the two messages for today, okay? One message, historical perspective, contemporary bias. Moshe and Yeshua, Kalev and the Avos, Mos. Second, precaution, safety, security, that's all in. Panic, losing your mind, sky's falling, who knows what's going to happen, that's out. Parsha Shlach is a perfect time to recalibrate between those two. Okay? Seischem l'shalom.
Thank you.
All you homebound girls.
Tonight. Well, some of us. 1, 2, 3,
2. Tonight.
I'm also going
tonight. Oh, is it an outro?